welcome everybody to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. Why? Because these queasy times call for humor and information while they're still allowed. We'll cover the ways this political climate is impacting Charlottesville citizens and learn about larger issues from their stories. Today, we're talking with Professor Patrice Preston Grimes, documentary filmmaker Lorenzo Dickerson, activist and refugee Kiberiti Majuto, and humor essayist Debbie Prum. But first, Nancy, are you there?
Ellen, I am here. Is it going to get boring if I say, because Trump hasn't killed us every Saturday when you ask me, or should I just do it the one time now and not do it again?
It's never boring. I mean, there's so much trauma that it's whatever kind of outlet we can get is helpful. So keep the humor coming.
I will. And if that's what that was. Anyway, I we're back from break. We're back to building our archive.
Did anyone notice that we weren't here last week? Yeah. Did anyone? We're going to show number four. When do we stop counting the shows is what I want to know.
Who's count? I don't know. Should we ask like the folks at some 5-year, like Cheers? Should we ask when they started counting? Do we just date?
Are you dating yourself again?
I'm sorry. Never mind.
I'm not cutting you off, but I just want to talk about our theme music before people forget about it. It's from Springtide out of Japan. It's called N3540 1918-1800 or 800, and it's from the album This Is the End. Do you have anything to say about that, the title of the album?
Do I?
Yeah.
So far I know Japan is still a safe country. I know we haven't insulted them enough to worry they're aiming nuclear missiles at us, so I feel good that we have so far chosen a very politically safe opening. What will we do, you know, if it came from somewhere controversial? I'm sure we'd be on someone's radar by now.
For sure.
We should count our shows. I'm sure it's going to matter. Anyway. It doesn't feel like we've been gone for 2 weeks, though. I know that we have.
I know.
Actually, like 14 weeks of events have happened, I'm sure, in our absence.
Yes. Is there anything that you wanted to mention?
Pence's face. I don't like it. I hate that earnest face of Pence. I hate it. That's it. I'm done.
I know. They do slick
those
so well.
Those lips bug me so much.
I'm going to mention some activism events to get people fired up a little bit. Indivisible Charlottesville is doing an event March 6th, that's Monday, at 1 at the office of Tom Garrett. They'll be gathering to let him know that we want answers. Garrett will supposedly be in the office that day for district work day.
Supposedly.
And then Surge Charlottesville, which stands for Showing Up for Racial Justice, Wednesday, March 15th at 7, they're holding a workshop on reparation. You can find them on Facebook at Surge Seville. And here on Apropos of Something, we are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Well, Nancy, we have a really fantastic show today. Maybe we should just get started, unless you have... I feel like you might have something to say.
No. Okay.
Always.
Of course, but apropos of the fact that you just introduced the show, I think that's a great idea. I'm with you, Ellen. Let's welcome our first guest.
Okay.
I'll let you do that, actually.
I'm really, really honored and grateful that we have Dr. Patrice Preston Grimes. Dr. Grimes is Associate Dean in the Office of African American Affairs and Associate Professor at the Curry School of Education at UVA. Welcome, Dr. Grimes.
Good morning. It's delightful to be here. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, hi, good morning. That's exactly, I know. Let's make it a good morning.
It will be.
I can't be more positive. This is as positive as I get.
Okay.
Yes. So I wanted you to, if you could, set the stage, Dr. Grimes, and give us some history, maybe some key dates of desegregation in the South or wherever you'd like to start.
Okay, thanks. It's amazing. Sometimes, unfortunately, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And as we're looking at our current political and educational and social climate, particularly looking at the appointment of the new Secretary of Education, it really gives us pause to look at where schools could go. And it's really helpful to inform ourselves of where schools have been. So as we're seeing resegregation in public schools, particularly here in Virginia and in the Richmond area in particular, it's important for us to realize that segregation is not a millennial situation, that it clearly was something that has been a part of the fabric of U.S. public education. So in Virginia in particular, at the end of the Civil War, blacks were allowed, and I've put that in quotes, to have public schooling, because prior to that time, in many, many circles, blacks, both enslaved and free, were forbidden to learn how to read or write. Yet at the same time, literacy and the ability to do that was a clear source of freedom, and that planted the seeds for education and the importance and value of learning and knowledge and understanding in African-American communities in the South. So very often we talk about the end of the Civil War, and then we fast forward to Brown versus Board of Education, which in 1954 specifically said by the Supreme Court that separate was not equal in the case of public schooling, and by 1956 that U.S. public schools were to desegregate with all deliberate speed. Then we tend to think about the civil rights movement that ensued. We have the Voting Rights Act and things that happened in the 1960s and the Johnson era, a period in the 70s, and then we find ourselves moving through various segments until today. But one of the key areas that I've researched, and I'm delighted to be here with Lorenzo Dickerson to talk about as well, is that period of time between the Civil War and Brown v. Board of Education. Sometimes people just think that that was a dark period or dark ages for African-American learning, and it was quite the contrary. So the work that I've initially done was looking at what I like to term valued segregated schools in the South in particular, and I've looked at Georgia and Virginia. And there was a particular period of time when, even though blacks were prohibited from learning to read and write, as well as restrained by resources and laws in terms of gaining knowledge, there was a resilience, there was an effort for that learning to occur, and that's the seeds of the work that really trained people like Martin Luther King, Vernon Jordan, and many of the civil rights leaders that we knew of in the 60s and beyond.
That, well, thank you, first of all, for putting that all in a very cohesive timeline. One of the things that I had not heard of is this term value, among other things, but anyways, this values segregated schools. Was it covert? I mean, what was the environment like to be teaching black kids how to read at, you know, when it was, as you said, forbidden?
Okay, well, let's remember that prior to emancipation, literacy in for blacks clearly in many places was against the law. However, once emancipation occurred, then blacks were free to set up their own schooling, so to speak, but the Jim Crow society, the de facto segregation, still kept everything very separate in the South. And so in terms of public accommodation, schooling, economics, resources, and so on. And so given that, there were several black communities, and I like to use plural. You know, sometimes we want to talk in monolithic terms, but black communities all over the United States, particularly in the South, were very communal. Many were cohesive in terms of their religious faith, their education. Economics dictated that things were segregated. And so in terms of shops and stores and things of that sort. And so blacks were determined that they were going to educate their children with the resources that they had. And Duke University had a project a few years ago called Behind the Veil. And so these were things that were very happening and vibrant and engaging. They just weren't necessarily apparently known to many people in dominant culture or society. That also tucks into the fact that there was a very active black press. And if you looked at papers like the Pittsburgh Courier, the Baltimore Afro-American, the Philadelphia Tribune, among others, it just an entirely separate, not equal in many ways, but nonetheless vibrant and engaging communities that existed all throughout the United States, especially in the South.
And did they, you know, in order to do all that, I mean, they weren't, you tell me, were they getting funding of any kind from the states, in, you know, that you're talking about, or they were doing this all out of their pocket?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because by law, Everyone paid taxes, including blacks. And yet their tax money was not going to the support of their separate schools. And again, Lorenzo's done some really great work here in Central Virginia, where he's documented in film and in oral histories of people who attended those schools. And so there were separate schools for blacks and for whites, public. The resources, by and large, were not equal. The pictures speak for themselves in terms of the facilities and things that were available. And yet, there was a commitment to education with teachers who were sometimes coming from the North to the South to teach, a group of people known as Jeans teachers who were being trained, other people who were being trained at historically black institutions like Hampton University, who were coming, Tuskegee, were coming to train and do that. And in many cases, black communities had to pool all of their resources just to have marginal facilities for their children.
Mm-hmm. And, like, where could, you know, because I'm assuming that most lawmakers weren't, you know, giving the time of day to these, you know, these struggles. So where did parents go to express their frustrations? What did they do?
It's interesting because as early as 1846 in Boston, there was a case where a black African-American parent brought to the school board of Boston that the schooling was separate and unequal. And in that 1846 case, that is how Boston schools became desegregated. And again, this was part of the entire Jim Crow era where separation of the races was mm-hmm. very clear and very explicit in many ways. And so black folks really had to rely on their own resources, their own revenue, skills, and abilities to make these schools happen, but still trying to petition people in public places to get equal and adequate education facilities.
Yeah, I did. You know, I know. Anyway, I just want to ask, the kids, you know, in these schools, how difficult was it to progress, to get educated? What were they up against just in the classroom?
If we can back it up just a little bit, I mean, one of the key issues in the South in particular was economic. And so children were put in the fields to work. Even though slavery had been abolished with sharecropping and with the economy, all of the South and many parts of the Midwest as well, for blacks and whites, lived on an agrarian calendar. And so children would go to school for certain times of the year, but then there were weeks and months at a time when children wouldn't go to school because they were needed to, you know, for the labor to support their communities. Even so, when children were able to go to school, the facilities that they had were very often 1 to 2 room schoolhouses, children in multiple grade levels being taught by, you know, one teacher, maybe perhaps some sort of assistant. And so segregated higher schooling, I guess, that existed tended to be more in urban areas or at county seats. So, for example, here in Virginia, the Albemarle County Training School was a place where students from many, many miles would come if they wanted to go beyond what we would say an equivalent today would be 6th to 8th grade. But if they wanted to do that, they needed to travel far distances to do that. And then in urban areas of the South at that time, that's when some of your larger African-American schools were built. Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C., Booker T. Washington in Atlanta. I can think of my husband's school, I.M. Terrell School in Fort Worth, Texas, where people came together in urban settings. But clearly, the facilities, the resources, the books and materials were clearly not equal, and people really had to fight to make sure that they got an equity with those sorts of things.
And I have a question, and also let me do a little station ID. We're listening now to 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Resistance Radio. We're talking to Dr. Patrice Preston Grimes, a professor at the Curry School of Education, about desegregation. We're also going to be talking to Lorenzo Dickerson, a filmmaker here. I had a question. Desegregation, what were the effects of that? I mean, we were all looking for, or we were so glad that happened, and then it was pretty disruptive.
Extremely disruptive.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. So kind of to back up a little bit, too, you know, the African-American communities did not exist in isolation from the rest of society. So as you think about the changes that occurred with World War One, you had the 1920s, and at that time there was the Harlem Renaissance, which I'm sure, Nancy, you're familiar with being in New York City. Then we moved into the 1930s and 40s, where school districts realized that in order to maintain separate but equal, that they would have to up their game with getting facilities more equal. And so that was literally a period where much money was then poured into black schools to try to fill the gap. When people could see that Brown v. Board of Ed looked like it was going to happen, they thought, well, if we genuinely get the schools separate but have the resources, it will be okay. So when 1954 comes and the Supreme Court says, all right, separate is no longer equal, this isn't something that happened overnight. And particularly in the South, it did not phase in until the 1970s, or late 60s and early 70s, that this happened. So there was a period, particularly in the South, of massive resistance where the government officials, including the governor of Virginia, said, we're just not going to do this. And then we have the very sad example in Farmville, Virginia, where Prince Edward County school officials, with the consent of the community, closed the schools for 5 years rather than to desegregate the schools so blacks and whites would go to school together. That's another story that we'll save probably for another broadcast. But to get back to your original question, honestly, there were some mixed feelings in terms of desegregating, because if we really look at what's happened in schools over the generations, I do not use the term integration. I've never used the term integration, because integration implies when you take two separate entities and you blend them and they become something new. That has never happened in public schools in America, really. There's always been this anticipation or expectation that a minority group would have access to resources, but they would become absorbed into the larger system, and the larger system would be the same. So many black folks, school officials, community leaders, and members realized that there was going to potentially be a loss of culture, of identity, of caring, of values in going from their own majority system into another system. And yet people weighed the pros and cons of that and thought that making that transition in the long run would be better off. Because as my dad used to say, anybody who says separate but equal was never separate. And so they really thought that they would gain more than they lost in doing so. And it's really had some mixed consequences, you know, since that time. Probably the key thing that people always have talked about up until the research has gone much deeper is that in doing that, schools were closed and black teachers lost their jobs. And that's been the narrative. But there was far more that had to be given up and exchanged in the process of blacks having access to the larger public school system.
Yeah, that makes total, it makes total sense, because you need everyone to be on board, you know, so even though if a law is passed, as you described, or a position has changed to be inclusive, you know, you cannot take for granted that everyone that needs to enact it is going to do their part, right? So you need everyone. Anyway, so you were trying to say something.
And I contend a lot of the major problems that we have in schools today are because we have never really grappled with what it means to desegregate and do it in a way that's holistic, that benefits everyone. So when we see incidents in schools today about discipline and the percentage, and this has been documented in research, my colleague Ann Gregory has done some great work at Rutgers in looking at the rates of discipline and suspensions for African-American males compared to other populations. That's an example of how we've got these imbalances and inequities, and in some ways I think it's because we did not take advantage of this incredible social and cultural capital that blacks had that they could bring to schools to help everybody learn how to educate everybody.
So we just have about a minute left, unfortunately. You are going to have to come back if you don't mind.
I'd be glad to, but I definitely want to leave time for Lorenzo, because
yeah, for sure.
He's done a beautiful job of showing people the story.
Yeah. Yes, so you both said something I heard. We've made time for him. If you could leave us with one thing, you know, for in 15 seconds, what would you want to leave us with? Or talk about the times now. I know that's a long topic, but do you have anything you'd like to add?
I would say the work is clearly not done, and that it is so important for everyone to engage to make sure that all children receive a high-quality public education.
Thank you, for sure. This is WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something with myself, Ellen Daniels, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Apropos of Something here at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are talking now, where we will be talking now, with Lorenzo Dickerson. But first,
Ellen, let me do the introduction on our one day's disaster since last we spoke.
Do it.
Now that Dr. Grimes has given us one of history's disasters ongoing, my disaster is when I don't know if you heard about when Muhammad Ali Jr. was traveling back from Jamaica to Florida. And Jamaica is not one of the seven banned Muslim countries, but nonetheless, when he was traveling back from Jamaica to Florida, he was stopped in Florida for over 2 hours by immigration because of his name, and despite the fact he had a passport, you know, a U.S. passport, and of course he was born in Philadelphia. It was all about his name. It was incredible, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. That's horrible. I actually did not hear that.
Yeah.
So my day's disaster, week's disaster, is also incorporates with it a glimmer of hope. The Oscars, that Moonlight one, I thought was amazing. The first LGBTQ film to win. It was also African American story. So that was really great. And the disaster, you know, was also the unfolding of the who won. And also Cittadini. Or the, you know, hair or BLOTUS was talking in his speech about stopping drugs from pouring into the country, poisoning our youth. And he said, we'll expand treatment for those who have become so badly addicted. And this is a quote from the Nation article. This is what Mike Pence did about drug addiction and about related issues. Vice President Mike Pence left drug users out in the cold and caused an entire HIV outbreak when he defunded Indiana's Planned Parenthood, the sole agency responsible for HIV testing in some parts of the state. So that's one of my disasters.
Yes, he's a piece of work, who apparently also, as you probably know, uses private email. That we learned this week, too, in addition. So let's pile on the man.
Yeah.
I'm all for it.
I'm all for it. And I'm also all for our next guest, if I may, introduce Lorenzo Dickerson. Dickerson is a documentary filmmaker and photographer. He's made four films. His most recent film, Albemarle's Black Classrooms, premiered last weekend in Charlottesville. So, Lorenzo, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hi.
Yes, you're very welcome. So you've made four films, and you only started making films 4 years ago. Is that right?
Yes. We've been working really quickly lately.
That is. So by the time you're 70, you'll have 70 films.
Maybe.
So what started this journey for you into filmmaking a little bit later in your life?
Yeah, well, my background is in marketing. So I've worked for different companies throughout my career in marketing, but I started doing a lot of ancestry research. I was really trying to build out my family tree so that my kids would have it. In doing so, I would find bits and pieces of information and tell my family about it, and they'd be really interested in it, but it was hard to follow the storyline. So I figured I would make a film so they could watch it from beginning to end. So I did that, and we premiered it at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center, and I fell in love with it after that.
Wow, that's fantastic. So, you know, we were talking. I got the opportunity to see some of your photographs yesterday, which was, they were really great.
Thank you.
We could talk about that, but I want to leave time to talk about your film, actually. And we talked about where you grew up, and I wondered if you could just talk about that a little bit, the way that you discovered where you lived.
Yeah, well, I'm born and raised in Albemarle County, went to school here in Albemarle County schools, and my mother's side of my family is from Ivy, Virginia, and my father's side is from Cobham, Virginia, which is right near Keswick. And growing up, which in the home that my dad still lives in today, the road that we live on is all family members. It's all African American. It's all family members. And we have a family church on the same road. And right next door is a Rosenwald school as well, one of the seven in the county.
So for people who don't know what that is, could you explain that, Rosenwald?
Yeah, Rosenwald schools. So African American schools were a lot of times one room schools that almost would look like a shack or a hut. And no windows, no heating, no cooling, that type of thing. But in the 19-teens, Julius Rosenwald, which was president of Sears Roebuck at the time, was approached by Booker T. Washington to create a fund that would fund the improvement of these schools. So a lot of times we would go from these one-room shack-looking buildings to two-room schools that had a lot of windows and emphasis on natural light. You had these potbelly stoves that were used to heat the building as well as cook. So it was really an effort to improve these schools for African Americans. Over 3,000 of them were built, and wow, 7 of them were in the county.
I think there's an interesting documentary just about his work in funding some of those schools.
Yes.
So go on with your story about where you lived.
Yeah, we were right next to the road where I'm from, where we live. There's a few very large pieces of property. So I've always wondered growing up as a kid, could that have been a plantation? Because it's interesting that all the African Americans in the community live on one road.
Right.
So in doing my first film and doing that ancestry research, I found that to be true. So right across the street, really, from where we live, there's the plantation, and multiple sides of my family, 3 different sides of my family were all enslaved on this plantation together.
Oh.
Yeah, that is, you know, to say the least, an incredible story. And the fact that your suspicion, once you discovered that your family essentially was on that road together, that was the last thing I thought you were going, you know, I had no idea that your inclination would be, I wonder, to say we're all slave, you know, in history, that they were all there for a reason, you know, other than because they were family. It was I was thinking, oh, how cool, you know, you guys were all living on the same street. That's amazing, you know. And no, wrong. You know, your hunch obviously proved sadly true.
Yeah, they purchased after emancipation, directly after emancipation. My great-great-grandfather and his siblings came together, which often happened with African Americans around that time. They would pool their money together and purchase land. So they purchased quite a bit of land right in that area, right near the plantation. And then over time, that land was just broken up between family members. It was passed down to descendants.
Mm. And so, you're still there, right? Is that right?
Family's still there.
So you're listening to 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, sponsored by the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. And this is, again, Ellen Daniels here and Nancy Lawrence. And we're speaking with Lorenzo Dickerson, who is a documentary filmmaker. I would love to talk a little bit about your film.
Yeah.
It's called Albemarle's Black Classrooms. So can you tell us a little bit about the overview of the film and some highlights?
Albemarle's Black Classrooms is a documentary film that tells the story of the history of education for African Americans, specifically in Albemarle County, from about 1910 and up to the present. So in the film, you hear from some UVA professors talking about the history behind education for African Americans, as well as the legal side. But then there's also historians that have done a lot of research here locally, as well as quite a few alumni from the various different schools throughout the county.
And how long is that, or was that really research? How long was the research process for you?
It was about 2 years total.
2 years? I just want to make sure I heard you.
After I made the first film, a friend, Miss Shirley Solomon Parrish, who went to one of these 7 Rosenwald schools in Albemarle County, she suggested to me that I make a film about Rosenwald schools. I thought about it for a while and then decided that I would go ahead and make the film, but to expand the story to education for African Americans in general in Albemarle County. But the film also talks about the state of Virginia as well.
And what did you learn? What were some of the most fascinating things that you learned in doing that film?
Yeah, one thing was I did not know that Esmont had its own high school, its own black high school, until I was actually in the middle of the filming process. And one of the alumni from Burley High School told me about Esmont High School. So then I kind of had to switch gears and make sure that I go in and research that. And we have someone in the film that's an alumni of Esmont High School. But also, I guess the most shocking thing was that, you know, we typically, when we see certain films, we see people in blackface, and we understand what that was during the times of Jim Crow. But in the process of my research, going through yearbooks and that type of thing, 1962, yearbook from Albemarle High School, which was the year just before Albemarle County integrated schools, there's a picture of a blackface minstrel show in the school that they had given.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, I was curious, just because white people are usually writing history and saving it and archiving it back then, to say the least. How difficult, was your research? Because I didn't see your film yet. Do you have visuals, or is it mostly interviews?
It's a lot of interviews, but the research, the research part of it, there's such a rich historian community here in Charlottesville, Albemarle County. So I did receive quite a bit of help. There's a group here called the Central Virginia History Researchers Group. And they meet once a month at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. So some of the people from this group are in the film sharing their research. So they found out some really interesting things. Like, there's an African American Catholic school that was in Keswick, and so someone had already done their research and found out that piece. So you see interviews, you see a lot of photographs. So we do have photographs of all the old schools, both inside and outside. So there's some photos of inside the classroom with the students as well.
And also the trailer's available. I mean, I wanted to give people ways to see the film a little later, but I feel like saying it now because the trailer are really great because they're really the personal stories, and you really get to see people in their own words talking. Can you give us maybe a little glimpse into a personal story, someone's insight there?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a sense of pride that goes around these African American schools. So, you heard Dr. Grimes talk about value segregated schooling. And when you talk to the alumni from these schools, they're very fond of their experience, even though they went to these schools and didn't have adequate books, didn't have adequate building in comparison, that type of thing. But they're definitely very fond of their experience. So you'll hear them talk about something called May Day that they had, which was kind of equivalent to Field Day, where they would compete against different schools. You hear them talk about the teacher being more like a second mother to them. They also had school with multiple grades in the same room, which, you may think that was a negative, but of course now Albemarle County is going more to that model, and they're calling it multi-age spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear these alumni talk about how they learned so much from the teacher being next to them teaching someone that was two grades higher. Mm-hmm. So they would learn from listening to what was going on in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's such a deep culture. Dr. Grimes was talking about that, too. Or it's such a great experience, probably, being together like that. And the disruption is a little bit unexpected. We don't think about it, perhaps, as white people, that there's a real negative effect, because we had no idea of what really was even going on. But it's kind of great to think about what was going on. When you say the teacher was like their mother, I mean, that really brings like a flood of feelings. I mean, it was probably this amazing experience that they had, would
definitely.
You say? Yeah. And you had mentioned something about during segregation or integration that sometimes people didn't really want to leave their school for that reason.
Yeah. So here in Albemarle County, schools were desegregated in 1963. Now, what that meant was they weren't fully desegregated. They had something called a pupil placement board in Virginia where basically, politicians would choose what number and where these students would go. So initially in 1963, you only had, say, four or five students that would integrate into a school. So full integration, if you want to call it that, took up until 1967 when Burley High School was closed. One of the people in the film, Monica Blair, talks about how desegregation was the burden was put on the African American student to be one of the few to integrate these schools and possibly be in a hostile environment, lose the culture, that type of thing.
I know you also did another film, The Color Line of Scrimmage, from also, well, I don't need to tell you, from, you know, that focused on the football team from 1956 mm-hmm. in a segregated high school. And I was wondering, because this one on top of your most recent film is looking at the civil rights movement from that period, is that an interest of yours, or is it just the historical aspect of African American history?
The civil rights movement in particular is very interesting to me, and it became very interesting to me when I was making this most recent film, Albemarle's Black Classrooms. And the reason I say that is because I'm very fascinated with the year 1963 in particular. And I came across that, of course, because that's when schools are integrated here in Albemarle County. But in doing the research, you know, I'm becoming more aware of President Kennedy being assassinated in that year, four little girls being bombed in Birmingham in that same year, March on Washington was in that same year, as well as Dr. Martin Luther King being jailed in Birmingham. So that year was definitely a pivotal time in American history, for sure.
And is that, since you're describing it such, is that in the works in your mind? Do you have a film or two or seven, you know, in your mind that you're thinking of approaching?
I do have a film idea in my head geared around the year 1963. I'm probably going to take the spring and summer off this year, at least as far as filming. A lot of reading will be done, a lot of documentary film watching will be done, a lot of research, but I'll probably pick it back up in the fall, and that could be what the next project is.
I think that's a good time to just take a quick break to say where people can see your film. Can we see it?
The DVD will be available on Amazon in a couple of weeks. If you go to moppintown.com, that's M-A-U-P-I-N, moppintown.com, you'll be able to order the DVD there. You can also watch the trailer there, but then also there will be some other shows even here locally, so possibly Scottsville Museum, in some of the Albemarle County schools, there'll be some showings as well. Then, of course, we'll be doing film festival submissions, too.
That's really great. And are you opposed to people contacting you on Facebook if they have an interest?
No, please do. Please do. I'm a social media guy, so please do.
Okay. Lorenzo Dickerson, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing that film very soon.
And in a year, we're going to see probably this next one. I'm guessing.
I hope so.
Every year,
yes.
You're saying.
Yes, every year we expect it. No.
Right.
So thank you. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Apropos of Something here on 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Up next is a guest who is sitting right here in front of me. His name is Kibiriti Majuto. He is an activist and all-around remarkable guy, I think. He is 18, and he was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he attends Charlottesville High School. Welcome, Kibiriti.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm glad everything's working over there in that chair. So you came here about 5 years ago from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I believe you left there when you were two, and you were in Africa and South Africa and many other countries.
Yes.
Until you got here just 5 years ago. Can you just talk about what that was like, what that journey was for you?
It was pretty long. Like, I had a lot of migrating to do, so I born in Congo, but then had to leave Democratic Republic of Congo, then go to Burundi. Then something also popped up in Burundi. Then we had to leave Burundi and heading for Tanzania. Then we went to Maputo. Then we end up in Cape Town, where we lived for 5 years as illegal aliens, as others might call it. But
so yeah, I didn't mention. Well, I mentioned earlier, but you're a refugee now.
Yep, I'm
right.
A refugee.
Okay, and so continue with what was going on there and why you had to leave each country.
A lot of conflicts were happening in a lot of the countries that we stayed in, and then ended up in South Africa. Then in 2008, when we arrived, that's when xenophobia rose in South Africa, and people were going crazy, like, didn't want immigrants. Even as we speak right now, it's happening where people are going around every door knocking, getting rid of, taking people out of the street, because apparently the people are scared that immigrants are taking away their jobs and other things such as that.
What happened in 2008, or what was the spark of that?
I don't know.
Is that when you got there, you're saying? So you, okay.
I got there, just started living in South Africa, were denied to go to school for an entire year. We couldn't go to school until we had to go to court and other stuff, a long process just applying for school. And then people were mad, and uprising started happening, kicking people out of their place of work. People were burned in the street and stuff like that, because there was this fear of immigrants coming into the hometown, and they were scared that they probably immigrants might rise up and take their jobs. But I do not know what was on people's mind, but at that time it was really scary. And then our father had to seek asylum, and then we seeked asylum to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And then you got here, and what happened then? Did you have the help of the IRC, I believe?
Yeah. Before we got here, it was a long process. We had an entire 5 years. We had to wait for the entire process to get in. You had to get checked. You had to go to the Department of Health, to see if you're healthy enough to get into the country, and so many other long processes. So the United Nations, if we had to apply. And then we got here, and we seeked out to the IRC and got us a job. We got my father a job and my mother a job to work in.
And then
for those 5 years, years where you were waiting, to get in, where were you? What was your life like for that?
It was scary, because you never know what's going to happen, if you're going to be next. If this happens to your next door neighbor, you might be the next one coming through and trying to get out, get kicked out of the country. So we were waiting to hear back from, Homeland Security, if we got accepted. And if we go on to with the process, because once you've got denied, you have to restart again, and you never know how long that will take. So for us, we waited for 5 years, and then each process that got in, we heard back that we got accepted. And then when you get accepted, you have to hear back, and they have to get interviewed by Homeland Security. They'll send their own person who would, to me, it seemed like an interrogation, because it was very quiet, they ask you questions. And they're like, if you come to America, are you only going to support the country? Things that don't make you very patriotic, and just trying to sense what type of person you are, if you're a threat to the country or not. Yeah.
You can imagine what it would be like now. That was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And then, just because we're short on time, I kind of want to get you. There's so much I know that you've been involved in. Can you talk about your social action, and you're quite an activist in town, and for the people that don't know you, can you talk about, what sparked that interest and what that's been like for you?
I feel like the thing that sparked my interest was that coming back from a really harsh background and seeing all the problems that I've faced, and coming to the United States and seeing that change is possible, I just could not sit there and just wait for somebody else to do the change for me. So I had to be able to speak up and get stuff, start moving. And so that's what really sparked my interest, especially in the background of seeing how it's like being in pain and knowing that the only way you have to do something kind to one another. That's what really made interest in also problems that I faced. So I was big into immigration, women's rights, and other human rights sources, because I've experienced how it's like when your rights are being taken away from you. So that piqued my interest into being an activist.
Yeah, so you're here to warn us kind of what it's like when we lose our rights, and what it really, you mentioned, because again, I got the chance to speak to you yesterday. Did you say something about machetes and people coming to
people?
Just a quick synopsis.
Yeah, if you was just at BBC yesterday, BBC, if you go to BBC, and there's
What's BBC?
BBC, British.
Oh, the broadcast
network? Yeah, the broadcast network.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and if you're just going to see and scroll down, if you click on the African section and scroll down and just look at pictures, you see the police with guns, people with machetes holding on their neck, walking around the street of South Africa. So when you're something like that, that's really scary, especially if you're a kid, seeing that. It's really traumatizing for a kid, knowing that you might get, if they know that you're if you are a foreigner or you an immigrant, you are in danger. And it's very traumatizing, because you never know, the next morning a parent of yours might be killed on the street.
Yeah.
You're talking about vigilante actions?
Yeah, vigilante actions, especially when here it's mostly the government who's doing most of the work. But when it comes into the people rising up and becoming vigilantes, you might have a situation like the Philippines where the president is actually telling the people, take the crime on your own hands, kill somebody if you know somebody who's addicted to drugs. But what if it's now turns out to be the people in the United States saying, we're going to kill anybody that's an immigrant because they're here to take our job. That should scare people a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you're in high school, being a student, are you finding that kids in, you know, in your classes are receptive to the things that concern you, or does your activism take you actually outside of high school?
It takes me a lot outside of high school. Yeah, it takes me a lot of outside of high school and just getting into the real world. But kids in my high school tend to be like very involved in activism and stuff that really that affects them as students, and they really want to take action, and you can see them trying to get involved in any way that's possible. So, but most of the time, my way of action has taken me outside of high school and gotten the opportunity to go to even Congress and like lobby for immigrants, so stuff like that.
And I know, I think, I'm not sure if Ellen alluded to it, but I know you were in charge of the town hall recently that Tom Garrett did not show up for, and that's very impressive. What was that like for you?
It was an uplifting experience, especially getting to see so many people who, one, they heard to be heard, but then Representative Garrett didn't show up or didn't even bring a staffer, so it was kind of disappointing because just shows how much of a tumultuous moment we're living in, and that people will do anything to get their voice heard, and that or practicing democracy. That's what democracy looks like, where people just, we voted, well, most did not vote for Tom Garrett, but they wanted, it just shows that we are scared and we want you to work for us. You work for us, so, and you didn't show up and they were mad.
And are your papers, how do you feel about your own situation since, you know, the election? Are you okay? Are your parent? You know, is your paperwork all right?
I'm very all right because I have a green card. I'm a resident. I'm a permanent resident of Virginia. I could apply for citizenship, but for those that don't have papers, they have like a really hard time and really scary time because you never know. They're scared that they might be the one next to get thrown out of the country.
Is your family the? Have any of your other family members come to the United States? Is it just you guys?
It's just us.
Oh, are others trying? Or no?
Oh no, then like it's a really long process. Even if they were to try, and you never know with the new administration. It might even be. I don't know if that ideology test might come into its room. Might be even much harder. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, you can have all that paperwork and still be not let in. So
yeah.
I don't envy you. Did you have plans to travel back to Africa? Do you ever consider just to visit?
Oh yeah, I would consider visiting Africa. Yeah.
So you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Kiberiti Majuto. He's an activist and refugee from Africa. And I think our time may be up. We need to hear from Deb Prum. But thank you so, so much. And you can, thanks.
Thank you.
There he goes.
Thanks for sharing your story.
Yeah, he's amazing. We barely scratched the surface with the work he's been doing in town, so we're grateful that he was here. Our next guest is Deb Prum. Deb Prum is an award-winning author whose work has appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, Ladies Home Journal, The Washington Post, The Writer's Handbook, and on NPR member stations. She is founder of Still Mountain Bookworks. Welcome to the program, Deb. She is going to read for us an essay that she has written. It is called Lost in the Loo at the Louvre.
What kind of person travels across Europe seeing splendid sights?
Well, guess what? Will you start again?
Thank you.
I will.
Fantastic. So this is Deb Prum reading. Let's do that again because we're not live or anything. Lost in the Loo at the Louvre.
What kind of person travels across Europe seeing splendid sights, eating marvelous meals, then comes home and writes about bathrooms? Yet why describe the sublime when you can as easily talk about the ridiculous? In Europe, the first order of business is determining which room is dedicated to your gender. Signs with words, even foreign words, give you a fighting chance of winding up in the right place. But symbols are another story. For example, at a science museum in Paris, both symbols on adjacent restroom doors sported triangular bottoms. A museum guard pointed me to the correct place, where I discovered that I needn't have worried. the ladies' room was as filled with men and boys as it was with women. This scene recurred all over Europe, men in the women's room and women in the men's room. In the U.S., bathrooms are relatively uniform. Many of our toilets and sinks have the words American Standard written on them, which I know is a brand, but it also seems like a description. There is no European standard. That meant I spent lots of time figuring out how to flush a toilet. Some options: a tank overhead with a pulley, a pull-up knob in the center of a lower tank, a foot pedal located in a non-obvious place, and an electronic system that punishes a wiggly person by splashily flushing at inopportune moments. Bathroom locks turned out to be as varied and inscrutable as flushing systems. My most scarring locked-in-the-bathroom experience occurred in the Louvre. I had just finished viewing the Mona Lisa, very nice, and headed to the bathroom. The stalls in that museum are a claustrophobic person's nightmare. Smooth stone walls extend from floor to ceiling, making them impossible to climb over or crawl under. As I approached, I could see French firemen swarming the ladies' room. A woman from Minnesota, I could tell by her accent, was marooned in the stall. A bystander told me that the museum had just put in a new locking system, which jammed frequently. This woman had the misfortune of getting stuck. The chatty fireman did not seem all that committed to hauling out Miss Minnesota in an expeditious fashion. I didn't stick around, so I don't know the end of the story. I can only hope those firemen are continuing to supply her with food, water, and adequate reading material. In Italy, many of the toilet seats in museums and churches had been ripped off the pedestal. Who steals a toilet seat from a church? How does that scoundrel sneak out with a seat? What does one do with a stolen toilet seat? Toilets in the Pisa airport possessed seats, but they were spring-loaded, an invention probably created by the devil. Those seats would stay down only if you exerted great effort. Therefore, if you are a human being who lacks ballast, say a light-bottomed adult or a small child, you are likely to be launched into the next stall. I'm not kidding, and I won't say to whom it happened. But by the end of our European travels, I overcame my ethnocentricity. I embraced variety, flushed with confidence, and nonchalantly marched into the men's room whenever necessary.
Bravo. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, you know, it must be the first time that the Mona Lisa was hardly the, you know, just was mentioned in a, as a mere descriptive. I'm curious, though, Deb, do you have a preference in France for this flushing system? You listed so many I had never heard of before. Did you arrive on one you liked?
Not really. I usually needed to ask the person in the next stall how to flush, which was not good because my French is pretty terrible.
So this is Deb Prum. She's an award-winning author. And she just read her essay, Lost in the Louvre, at the Louvre. Not to interrupt, Nancy, if you feel like you have some more burning questions.
Burning with fleshing? No. That's good. Thank you for that. I mean, have you actually experienced this fleshing system in other countries, or is it France the one that is so striated with options?
It was France and Italy.
This is WPVC 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Thank you so much, Deb Prum. I want to thank our other guests, Dr. Patrice Preston-Grimes, Lorenzo Dickerson, Cabriti Majuto. Nancy, we have little time.
We're at the race, right?
We're at the
time
race.
For a palate cleanser?
Go.
Okay. Mine, you will maybe not be too surprised, is still Fixer Upper on HGTV. It is my cocoon movie thing where no one ever, clients are always happy, budgets are never an issue, deadlines are met, houses are constructed, and everyone is happy, and it's my total comfort TV. Your turn. What do you got?
I'm making bacon-wrapped water chestnuts today. Three ingredients: brown sugar, Worcestershire sauce, ketchup. It's delicious. That's what I'm going to say. We'll see you next week. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Bye, Nancy.
See you, Al.